live for Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors with your host, Drew Kirby.
Yeehaw!
Okay, okay.
Holy cow!
May I have your attention, please?
Hey, this is Luke Holmes.
I am Morgan Wallen.
I'm Riley Green.
I'm Travis Denning.
Hey, I'm Aaron Lewis.
Hey, it's Luke Bryan.
I'm Tim McGraw.
What's up? This is Ian Munsick.
Hi, this is Craig Morgan.
And you're listening to
Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors. My Country 95.5. It's no secret that Wyoming is home to some of the greatest fishing and hunting in the world.
Wow! It's colossal. It's stupendous. It's magnificent.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors on My Country 95.5. Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors on My Country 95.5.
Here we go, Jen, and as we are rapidly approaching the end of January already, which means we're getting closer and closer to March when have those open meetings with the public. And one of the guys that is out doing a lot of the number crunching and number gathering is Justin Benfit, wildlife biologist, and you guys have some information today.
That's right, Drew. Thanks for having us on and giving us the opportunity to talk to everyone about kind of what we do in the wintertime as wildlife biologists. And so with us, Justin is here to give us a little update about all the surveys that have been going on in the air, on the ground, all around the state. And then hopefully we can give a little summary about.
Justin, you guys have been in a helicopter. You've been up and down for weeks now, kind of collecting data. What are you guys seeing from high above the ground?
Ask me again in a couple of weeks. And I just say that kind of tongue in cheek, Drew, because, you know, we're just in the middle of compiling all that stuff. So it really kind of just depends on where we're at, you know, in the fall and winter period with our various surveys, because we do several different types of surveys. So, in fact, we've got a helicopter here in Casper at our compound right now, and we're doing some deer surveys right now as we speak. So we're still in the middle of compiling a lot of that information.
When you guys are collecting this type of data, how does it really figure into the season settings? I mean, if you see low, low numbers, then that's low, low licenses?
Yeah, that's certainly part of it. So, you know, our season setting process is really, it's a year-round process. It never ends. You know, we kind of start what we call the beginning of the biological year. So we'll call that early June. You know, beginning of June, that's when most of your fawns and calves and that sort of thing are hitting the ground. You know, we're out there during the summer months collecting habitat data in places, just getting a general feel for range conditions and what kind of forage production is out there and how good a body condition these animals are going to enter the winter in. And then we go through those fall hunting seasons and we're out checking out, hunter harvested animals for body condition. From talking to hundreds of hunters over the course of the fall, how seasons went, how they perceive seasons to have gone. As we get, you know, through the main deer and antelope seasons, get into that November timeframe, that's when we start doing our deer flights. We do that during the rut, you know, the breeding season. So when those big mature bucks come out, and it helps us get a much more representative sample of how many buck deer out there. So that's when we do our sex and age ratio counts for deer. And then we do some winter elk flights. And then now we have these winter, what are called sightability flights. Then we feed all that information to our population models. We look and see how well hunters did through our harvest surveys, how many animals they harvested, what success rates were. Once we get a population estimate through our modeling processes and that sort of thing, it you know, we kind of see where these populations are in relation to our management goals. And then we formulate our next year's season recommendations based on that. Do we want to allow for population growth? Do we need to try to decrease the population, kind of keep it the same, that sort of thing? And then that all culminates with a round of, public meetings, lots of landowner meetings, that sort of thing. So the whole public process. And by the end of it, we have season recommendations for the next fall.
Let's get back to the sightability flights. You guys have been taking these flights. Basically break down what these sightability flights do and how they help in the counting of the herds.
So, Drew, just as a reminder, these sightabilities are a little bit different than our normal flights that we do, just our normal classification flights. And so the sightability is pretty important. And I'll let Justin explain all the ins and outs sightabilities.
Like Janet said, you know, we do kind of two main flights. Let's just take deer, for example, because that's what we're working on now, and specifically mule deer. In November, during the rut, like I was saying, that's when we're getting our sex and age ratio data. So we find random groups of deer in these randomly sampled areas, and you know, how many bucks mature bucks, yearling bucks, and fawns do we have for every 100 does that are out there? And those ratios are really important to inform your population model. But now we're doing what are called sightability flights this time of year. And it's really kind of a more recent thing. It's really only been in the past decade that we've started conducting these flights. I really have to thank our Game and Fish Commission, because our division chief, Rick King, pushed really hard to get this mule deer monitoring package in place. And our Game and Fish Commission stepped up to the table and they authorized $2.5 million over the next 5 years. So part of that monitoring package gave all of us a whole big boost to our flight budgets for these sightability flights. We really fly a herd really, really intensively with these randomly selected polygons, you know, so it's kind of a random sample, but we fly in our case around Casper, the bulk of the herd. And we're basically trying to physically count every single deer that we find. We're not trying to classify them, because as we're in late January, a lot of bucks have already lost their antlers. But then as what we do is for every group of deer that we see, we also assign, you know, we use the term covariates, right? But these different variables that are in place, like how much snow cover is there, how much timber cover, what's the vegetation type that they're in? Is it grass? Is it mixed shrub? Is it aspen? Is it a conifer, you know, pine tree cover, that sort of thing? And then are the animals walking, running, or standing when you saw them? And all that feeds into this survey, and basically is what it enables you to do when you're all done, is you can calculate a coefficient, which is basically like a multiplier. And it says, hey, we think we have this many deer, and we get a pretty tight statistics around it. So it gives us a lot of confidence in the number that we get. And it really anchors those models. It really helps validate our population estimates. And so we put a lot of stock into the data that comes out of these surveys. And, but boy, they're kind of expensive, so we can't afford to do it all the time everywhere.
Awesome, Justin. Thank you so much. You guys hang tight. We'll be back in just a few minutes to talk more about the process of how we set those licenses right here on Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
My Country. You're listening to Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors. My Country 95.5.
Welcome back to Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors. Justin Benfitt, Janet Millick from Game and Fish is with us today. All right, Janet, so we have collected data, and now what's the process after these flights?
We still have so much to consider, right? We have the winter that has played out, and now in Wyoming, although this winter has been a little bit more severe, a lot of our winter is more mild and then has shifted to a little bit harsher spring. So some of our stuff is getting a little bit later that we have to kind of change our license structure that we're issuing. And so that's why we always put out these preliminary numbers. And then once our commission sees everything and makes that decision, usually at our April commission meeting, we have until May 1st to get all of that information out to hunters. So even though we have the models, we have the numbers, we can make those issuance on licenses, we still have the ability to change that depending on what happens. And we look at so many things.
Yeah. And so another part of it, Drew, is like, let's just take the mule deer example we've been using. So, you know, we have two types of hunting in Wyoming. We have limited quota and general hunting. And so in a case of like where we're flying these sightability surveys right now, south of Casper, we don't have a number of tags we issue. Is what it'll do in that case is rather than say, oh, we're going to release more or less tags, we may become more or less liberal or conservative on the season, like longer season length, or, you know, we have a 3-point or better season out there right now. Maybe we would pull that if we had more bucks and, you know, have it just be antler deer and that sort of thing. So versus when you get to limited quota, then you're talking about either, you know, cutting or increasing or staying the same with your license numbers.
And so biologists also have to really consider public opportunity too, Drew. So when they look at the calendar every year, they have to incorporate, gosh, you know, is this going to be a weekend, one weekend that it's only open? Is it a whole month that it's open? Is it open over the holidays? Because, you know, there's data to kind of show how many animals are going to be harvested in an area and when. And so we kind of make sure to look at, you know, providing the public with the most opportunity that we can and still manage the population.
Your focus this time was on mule deer. Will you focus on antelope, say, next season, and then elk the year after? Or is there really a set way that you guys go about that?
It's a good question. So with this new mule deer monitoring package, we're going to focus on mule deer in at least one or two of the herds every year for these sightability surveys. But we still have a real need to collect that same kind of similar data with elk and antelope. And so like with elk, you know, we'll do a really big sightability elk flight in the Laramie Peak country again next winter. We just can't afford to do them all at the same time. And then, you know, we have some issues in the Black Hills where we need to dedicate some money. And then when we do those classification surveys, like I was talking about for mule deer in November, for antelope, we actually do that before the season in August. And that's because antelope, you know, and they'll lose a lot of their horn sheaths and stuff come November anyway. And they're bunched up in these big groups. So we actually do that before the season. We do that from the ground, but then we do a similar thing to sightability for antelope, except they're called line transect flights. And we do those in May every year. And that's where we fly this grid pattern in a herd. It helps you get a good density estimate throughout your whole hunt area. And we do that in May because those antelope are breaking up and they're having fawns. And so they're not in these big, huge groups and they're more randomly spread on the landscape. And then you have a really good green backdrop with spring green up and that sort of thing. And so it allows us to get pretty good population estimates on antelope that way.
And so, Drew, I want to make it very clear to the question that you asked. While we are talking about this sightability survey, which is above and beyond our normal work for mule deer this year, all of the surveys go on every year. So this, what we're talking about now with these sightability surveys, is just above and beyond our normal counting for the year.
So it's an ongoing process to, you know, even before the meetings begin in April, you know, you guys have already been working almost a year to get the numbers correct.
Absolutely. And Drew, just like we're going to hammer out again, the public is a critical, critical part of that. And I know everyone always says, I'm not going to go to those meetings. I'm not going to give input because they don't listen to us anyway. Well, we do listen. It might not always change the numbers and the science, but we do listen and it does make a difference. So check stations, harvest surveys, coming to public meetings are all just is a huge critical part. So we just really encourage people to keep that in mind, and we're here to listen at any time.
And when we get closer to March, we'll talk more about those public meetings.
Absolutely. Keep your eyes open.
Filming, hooking, and hunting outdoors. My Country, 95.5.
Ice fishing is upon us, Brian. Man, we've got lots of fishing tournaments and fishing opportunities over the next month or two.
Yeah, and we've had really pretty good ice for, especially this time of year. We've had some good cold weather, and we got the Hog Derby just around the corner.
Now, we've been talking about the Hog Derby and Pathfinder, and Game and Fish has said the ice is great up there, and there may be some other things going on with that. They're getting prepared to go this week, so we encourage you to go over and check out their Facebook page. It's the Hog Derby Ice Fishing Tournament on Facebook. It's simple to find, and you'll get more information there.
Yeah, I think the Pathfinder Boat Club has a Facebook page also that does have some of that information on it as well.
So when folks are heading out, and I've talked to a couple of people that have been fishing up at Pathfinder, and last week they didn't get anything. They sat there all day and didn't catch a fish, they said. He said it was just a slow bite, but then the weekend before, they were catching fish like crazy.
Yeah, I think it was kind of slow for the guys over at Boisen as well. So it might have just been weather patterns or, you know, moon phase or whatever was going on. But, yeah, I've heard some pretty good reports on Pathfinder, especially on the trout side of things. You know, a lot of good 3 to 5 pound trout. The guys that are moving and kind of know what they're doing on the walleyes are, you know, catching a lot of those small ones for sure.
So here in the store, you guys have a great section that is all ice fishing, from ice huts to sleds and all the rods and reels and baits.
Yep, propane heaters, the propane, that kind of stuff. Tip-ups, you name it, ice augers, everything's moving pretty good.
You know, one of the things that are very important that you did mention is the heaters, especially when we get to the points where we're at negative degrees. I mean, to be out sitting on ice in negative temperatures, it's always smart to have that extra warmth.
Yeah, I was talking to a buddy today, and you know, it's the cold's not really the problem, especially when you're in you know, one of those ice shelters and you got a heater going. You know, sometimes it's like a little sweat lodge in there. Yeah. It's the wind. You know, if we can keep the wind off your backs, you know, it makes things a lot more enjoyable.
Which obviously having the proper clothing will help you out big there too, because if you have the wind cutting clothes and the clothes are insulated, really does a big difference.
Yeah, you know, when you're ice fishing, a good pair of like muck boots or bogs boots, something that's going to be waterproof. So when you're drilling those holes and you pull that auger up through the ice and it pulls that water up through there, you know, you want to stay dry. And then you want to definitely be layering up, because, you know, you might be pulling a sled, you know, 100, 200 yards out to the ice, and, you know, you're going to heat up pretty quick and then start sweating. So you want to be able to layer up so you can take some clothes off.
So if you're spending some time out there and maybe you're going to camp up there, there's still people that are brave enough to go out and you know, brave the negative degrees. Maybe you're going to need to cook something up there and eat.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a couple different organizations that are going to be up there at the Hog Derby this next week, and HD Outdoors is taking a good amount of, I think there's 20 or so veterans that are going to be up there, and they're going to get up there and drill a bunch of holes. And then the North Platte Walleye Club also has an outing, and they're coming with their ice trailer, and they've got tip ups and jigging rods and augers, and they usually put together a little feed, do a chili, burgers and chilies during the day. So if you see that North Platte Walleye trailer, I mean, stop by and say hey and maybe get some tips and maybe a bowl of chili.
One of the things that I love about the Hog Derby is, sure, you know, there's prizes given out, but really it's more of a big fun festival where, you know, everybody's out there. There's all kinds of organizations like you're mentioning, and it's kind of more of a fun atmosphere than a tournament.
It's like a little community on ice out there, you know, and everybody's willing to kind of help each other, you know, respect each other's space when you're drilling holes and setting up camp. But it's an awfully big lake, and there's plenty of places to fish.
So check it out again. Go check out their Facebook page, the Hog Derby, or the Pathfinder Boat Club, and you'll be able to figure it all out and check that out. And make sure you stop in here to get all your license and everything before you head up, because that's really important this time of year too.
Hooking and Hunting Outdoors on My Country 95.5.
We're back. Wyoming is a great place for outdoors, and we have been talking about hunting and fishing, and Brian, really there's not a time when you can't get out and do something, because you can start fishing for walleye and trout as soon as the ice melts off.
Right, but I'm not doing anything today. 4 degrees is just a little too cold for me to do anything other than stay home and make green chili.
You know, I really admire the people that go out and ice fish when it's below zero temperatures. And, you know, most of the time they're in those little huts, but still, you got to go outside at some point.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the cold definitely, you know, puts a little strain on everything. Equipment, you know, even tip-ups, you know, guys got to kind of prep those properly, make sure they're lubricated with something that's not going to gel up or freeze up on them. You know, and having your vehicles, your propane bottles, if you got a propane auger, you know, you got to keep those propane tanks, you know, somewhat, because it is a liquid. Otherwise, your propane auger might not fire up. So there's definitely some challenges with the colder weather.
When we talk about that, how cold is too cold for propane?
Boy, that's above my pay grade. I don't know. You know, I don't have a propane auger, but it is definitely one of those challenges. And really, it's kind of it can be a challenge now for guys that are running like the lithium batteries on their hand augers. You know, right. So you've got like the Strike Masters or the a couple different versions of augers that just attach to your brushless like Milwaukee batteries or your drills. And you know, if you don't keep those somewhat, you know, warm climate, maybe at least in your truck,
yeah,
you know, you're gonna, you know, eliminate the number of holes you're gonna be able to drill.
Which we've been talking a lot about that. If you're someone that goes out and drill one hole and then complain about not catching anything, there's a reason.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I hear a lot of guys here at the store coming through and they're like, oh, yeah, I was at Pathfinder and, you know, I sat there all day and didn't catch anything. And I'm like, well, did you move? Well, no, it was too cold. We didn't, you know, we didn't drill any more holes. And it's like, man, it's like, you know, it doing the same thing over and over, you know, it just, you know, kind of, you know, makes you think about what the heck you're really doing. So, you know, don't be afraid to go shallower, go deeper, look for some structure. If you've got, you know, one hole that's producing and it's at 20 feet, then maybe you take your rest of your tip ups and you find that 20 foot edge and you start fishing that edge line a little more aggressively. But yeah, I mean, the guys that are effective are guys that are moving around. And, you know, if you're not checking tip ups, to me, like every 45 minutes to an hour, you got to sometimes wake up that minnow if that's what you're fishing with, you know, and
right.
and make sure it's still alive and that a fish didn't strip it off your hook. And, you know, a live minnow is a pretty inexpensive overall. And it's better to have live bait than dead bait.
You had mentioned minnows if that's what you're fishing. What's the big bait right now that you've heard? I know you guys carry minnows here at Rocky Mountain, but.
Yeah, you know, I think majority of people like running minnows, you know. Everything eats a minnow, you know. I mean, just put a steak in front of us. There's not very many of us that don't eat a steak, right?
Mm-hmm.
Usually, like on tip ups, what I'll typically do is, you know, I'll put four or five tip ups out with a minnow on there. Maybe I'll throw a maggot or a mealworm on one just for something different. But I'll keep one rod available so I can just sit there and jig, and I'll keep changing out my lure. You know, I'll run a jigging wrap for a little bit, maybe a shiver minnow, maybe I'll run a cast master. I'll just change out different presentations. And
what about colors? Overcast a lot these days with snow coming in and everything. So are they different? Are you going bright colors?
For ice fishing, I mean, the ice obviously kind of cuts down the amount of reflection and sun that's going through anyways. And mm-hmm. if there's snow on top of the ice, you're getting even less. A lot of guys typically like anything with a glow pattern, you know. There's a lot of good different options out there. There's tungsten jigs that have good glow patterns. All the shiver minnows, well, most of the shiver minnows have glow. There's a lot of good options. And so just a white glow, a chartreuse glow, green glow, those are kind of your more common colors. But, I mean, you just never know until you go.
Right.
I mean,
and like you said, where you change it out if you're not catching anything after mm-hmm. 20, 30 minutes, change it out for a different color.
And it's a hassle. I mean, you get it, you know, my hands are cold. You got to take a snap or retie a line, that kind of stuff. But, you know, the guys that put the time in and the effort in, you know, they're the ones that are usually more successful.
Which, you know, obviously here in Casper and in the surrounding areas, fishing is so huge. So mm-hmm. you could go into any shop and just kind of ask people what they're seeing to, right. to kind of get some inside scoop.
That's always good to just kind of look at the shelf and see what products are missing and which ones have low quantities of product. You know, it's when there's a hot bite, you know, a lot of times, you know, their buddy told another buddy and pretty soon the peg's empty.
Yeah.
So just watching and kind of seeing what sizes and maybe what colors and patterns.
And of course, as we've been talking about, taking what you catch, especially if it's those medium to small size walleye up there on Pathfinder.
Don't be afraid. There's not a size limit there. There is a possession limit, of course. But don't be afraid to, you know, keep some 12 to 15 inch fish. I mean, there's an overabundance of those smaller ones, and there's just the lake just doesn't have the forage base to really help those fish get any bigger. So by thinning some of those smaller walleyes out, it does help those other fish grow bigger.
When you're catching those walleyes this time of year, are you cooking them, and are they tasting the same as they do in the summer?
Delicious.
Yeah. Good now, good then,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I mean, it's been, they're pretty good all year round. You know, sometimes, you know, with the trout, you know, you start hearing stories about trout getting soft in the summer months where their water temperatures start heating up, especially on you know, on some of the river systems where the water's not real deep and doesn't stay very cold. But the cold water, especially at Pathfinder, pretty much year round. I mean, you're gonna have great taste in fish.
It's like having fish on ice all the time,
all day.
Get out here and check them out before you head out to any of the derbies you're going to do, or maybe just heading out for a family fishing trip. Stop in here, Rocky Mountain Discount Sports. Big show coming up next week. If you missed any of this show or previous shows, hit us up in the My Country 95.5 app on demand.